And when you listen to TV ads from the last few decades, it can be hard not to laugh.
Sense it. The power of Old Spice. The mark of a man.
This is an Old Spice commercial from 1978. It's so slow, so earnest, so typical of ads of its time. That was before VCRs and TiVo and DVRs, technologies that let viewers zap ads or fast-forward through them. Those technologies have turned advertising into a cat-and-mouse game for marketers. They've had to become more creative in making ads that consumers will choose to actually watch. To talk more about this, we call Teresa Etzi. She's written a new book called The Idea Writers. Thanks for coming on the program.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So, we've got the Super Bowl coming up, and that is the biggest advertising moment of the year, with TV commercials almost as much a draw as the game. But generally, advertising these days is not focused as much on TV spots. Is that not true?
That's very true. I think the Super Bowl is a great example of some of the bigger changes that have happened in the industry. You know, historically, you had brands who would create these commercials for the Super Bowl and spend millions of dollars making the ad, and then the ad would run for its 30 seconds, and then that would be it, more or less. And I think now what a lot of advertisers are doing with the Super Bowl are still running the ad because it's still a mass vehicle, but also using that and then activating it somehow online, whether that's through Facebook or Twitter or having a contest. There's some ongoing conversation with the consumer that happens.
Well, let's use a hugely successful ad from last year to break this down just a little bit. It started out on TV and then it migrated to then it showed up on the internet. People sent it to each other. People sought it out because they heard about it. It's the Old Spice ad, the man your man could smell like.
Hello, ladies. Look at your man. Now back to me. Now back at your man. Now back to me. Sadly, he isn't me. But if he stopped using lady-scented body wash and switched to Old Spice, he could smell like he's me.
So I think the reason this ad was so successful is that, first of all, it was just hilariously funny. You know, he starts in the bathroom, he's wearing nothing but a towel, and he's got chiseled abs, and he's a great-looking guy, and he says, "Hello, ladies." And then it goes from there. He moves from his bathroom onto a beach, and then it ends with, "I'm on a horse." And it's sort of absurd. And I think that's why it just captured everybody's imagination. And I think it was one of the rare examples from the last few years of an ad that, you know, you'd walk into your hairdresser or whoever, and they had seen it. That TV commercial then became an online phenomenon. It was, you know, watched by tens of millions of people online. And then you had countless parodies.
Which parodies, which speak, of course, to today, people want to interact.
Absolutely. And I think that is the holy grail for marketers. Every marketing case study can point to, well, our ad was viewed this many millions of times on YouTube. We've increased our Facebook likes by 1,000%. There's all of these metrics that you can point to. And that's, you know, the million-dollar question is, does this all translate? And in the case of Old Spice, according to the agency, they pointed to a lot of different metrics. But at the end of the day, they also reported a 107% sales increase by the time the TV campaign and the online campaign had run their course.
We've been talking about certain ways of participating. There's also another level, and that's literally physically with the interacting with the product. There's an online test drive from Mitsubishi.
Yeah, that was a really interesting example. Mitsubishi and their agency created this means by which you could, sitting at home in your underwear, do a test drive. And that's not a virtual test drive, like not pretend to drive a car on your computer. That's easy. This was actually, you could control a physical car that was driving around a track by sitting at home. And I think now the most interesting campaigns are bringing the digital and physical worlds together.
How is the industry, Madison Avenue, I'm thinking of the big storied agencies, are they adapting or is a lot of this coming from, you know, scrappy newcomers?
A lot of the big agencies over the years became built around TV commercials. And so when the internet happened and it meant that TV wasn't the only way to interact with people, the big agencies were slow to respond. And I think now It's taken a little while, but big agencies are starting to do more interesting digital work. But you also have a whole new generation of, as you call them, scrappy new companies that were built post-digital revolution and that weren't built around one media.
What might we see next?
Yeah, I think it's going to be really, really interesting in the next couple of years. I think obviously mobile is an exploding area. And I think now with smartphones and location awareness and tablets and, you know, you've got multiple screens speaking to each other, I think you're going to see a lot of the most interesting things in advertising happening with that.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Teresa Etze is editor of Creativity, an online publication that's part of Ad Age. This music heralded the first episode of Masterpiece Theater 40 years ago this month. What came next was the stately, well-dressed host sitting in an armchair next to some dusty books.
Good evening. I'm Alistair Cook. We open tonight a new television theater, which in the next year will show you plays adapted from...
Notice he said next year. Alistair Cook was a respected journalist at the time, and he refused offers to host the new series. When he finally agreed, he signed a one-year contract. Here's Masterpiece's executive producer, Rebecca Eaton.
After he saw the first show, he was so dubious about the possibility that the whole thing could be a success that he thought it would just fade away after one season.
Fade away, it did not. And Alistair Cook hosted for 21 years. The show originally came to America through the PBS station WGBH in Boston. It was a way for the station to fill up the roster of a very new public television network. Robert Thompson is a professor of television and popular culture at Syracuse University. He says Masterpiece Theater appealed to audiences looking for a change from the commercial fare of the 60s.
In 1971, we'd gone through a decade of talking horses and genies and witches that were housewives.
In contrast, the programs broadcast on Masterpiece Theater were adaptations of great literature and original dramas. They had top-notch production quality with the BBC's funding power behind it. And they featured British acting giants, previously unseen by American audiences. The likes of Judi Dench, Helen Mirren, and later Colin Firth in Pride and Prejudice.
I believe every disposition has a tendency to some particular evil.
Your defect is a propensity to hate everyone.
Well, yours is willfully to misunderstand them.
Colin Firth, for one, is still reaping the benefits of that early exposure as Mr. Darcy. Over the decades, executive producer Rebecca Eaton says Masterpiece has garnered fans ranging from Whoopi Goldberg to Michael Bloomberg to the Tea Party's Christine O'Donnell. It has gone through changes from the theme to the name, from Masterpiece Theater to just plain Masterpiece.
We were scaring people off with the theater, particularly theater spelled the British way, which is T-H-E-A-T-R-E.
The content has also changed to embrace the contemporary. There was the police procedural Prime Suspect and the miniseries Traffic about the drug trade, which became a blockbuster movie as well. Still, Masterpiece is today the home of costume drama. And like any icon, it will always have imitators, like, say, another famous PBS name.
Good evening. Alistair Cook here. Welcome to Masterpiece Theater.
Portland, Oregon is ready for its close-up.
Tonight, the city gets its own sketch comedy TV show. It's called Portlandia on the Independent Film Channel. The program may extend the fame of Portland, which up to now has been better known for its food, its music, and of course as the hometown of NPR correspondent Ari Shapiro.
Near Carrie Brownstein's home in Portland, there is a locally owned, environmentally friendly pet store. Carrie shops there, but sometimes she feels a little judged.
When you go in, we're selling lamb bones and meat, and you can even buy like a trachea. But then when you ask for a leather leash, they say, oh my gosh, we do not sell anything with leather. And I just think, how am I supposed to do this? Like, I just want to be a good person. Now I just want to go to PetSmart.
That, in a nutshell, is Portlandia. One sketch takes place in a restaurant where the waitress tells Carrie and her co-star Fred Armisen about the chicken on the menu.
Woodland-raised chicken that's been fed a diet of sheep's milk, soy, and hazelnuts.
Okay, this is local?
Yes, absolutely.
I'm going to ask you just one more time, and it's local?
It is.
Is that USDA organic or Oregon organic or Portland organic?
It's just all across the board, organic.
So the hazelnuts, these are local?
Fred Armisen is best known for playing President Obama on Saturday Night Live. He and Carrie have been friends for years. They created a series of web sketches that eventually spawned this show. Carrie didn't have any TV experience. She was in the band Slater Kinney, and she once wrote a blog about music for NPR.org. In making this show, she had the advantage of being local.
To me, it is an absolute love letter to Portland. I've tried to live elsewhere, and I can't. I always come back here.
I should mention that you, Carrie Brownstein, are sitting here in the interview wearing a plaid shirt.
I am. I actually took off a flannel shirt to come down here to be interviewed by you.
I asked Carrie to take me on a tour of my hometown, to places so emphatically Portland that they could translate almost verbatim to the show Portlandia. We walked to a tiny independent bookstore called Reading Frenzy. Andrea Deacon volunteers there.
Pretty much, you know, the goal is to have things that are kind of hard to find at most, like, mainstream, bookstores or things like that.
Carrie, what have you got there?
I have issue number 2 of Moldy Soy, which the burning question on the cover of this issue is he still a vegan boy? It's a $2 zine.
Wait, and I just have to say, the superhero with a V on the cover is saying, that time with the pizza was totally an accident. They said it was vegan cheese.
This bookstore was the model for one of the Portlandia sketches. Fred and Carrie play the owners of a feminist bookstore concerned about everything except selling books. Actor Steve Buscemi makes a cameo as a customer who just wants to buy a book and leave.
You want me to buy something now?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. This is good. She's no lady.
That's actually a series. So there's another 14. So you've got to subscribe.
Yeah, I just want this one.
It's a series book, so those are...
That's the thing. Book 13, you find out she is a lady. And it pains me to imagine you not knowing her journey.
It's a safe bet that next to almost any business in real or imaginary Portland, there is a coffee shop. Next door to Reading Frenzy is Courier Coffee. The owners roast sustainably harvested coffee beans in a garage. They use ceramic coffee cups that their friend made. The company only delivers beans within bicycling distance. It's easy to imagine one of Fred's characters from Portlandia stopping by.
Watch out, bike. Cars, man, why?
I don't have a driver's license.
I don't need it.
I get a bike lane here.
Hey, I get this whole lane.
10 feet rule.
Oregon state law, 10 feet.
Hey, birds.
You guys have little bikes?
The cyclists at Courier Coffee are not so intense, but they do have a specially designed cargo bicycle that can carry 200 pounds of beans. Tyler Hauptman and Ryan Donaldson are behind the bar. They roll up their sleeves to show their coffee tattoos.
I have a cup and crossbones on my lower arm.
That's cup and crossed spoons, like a skull and crossbones, but with a coffee theme.
And then I have a French press surrounded by coffee tree on my shoulder. Ryan is a portafilter.
Oh, mine's just a steaming portafilter on the back of my arm.
The portafilter is the handle thing that people right. put in the espresso machine. Okay.
There's also a menu of pastries baked in-house.
Holding true, there is one vegan on staff at Courier Coffee, and that's me. So we'll usually have one or two vegan things.
Vegans have really benefited from affirmative action here in Portland.
Just down the block from Courier Coffee is a shop called Tender Loving Empire. Every corner is crammed full of locally made art, music, and clothing. Carrie Brownstein says a little while ago she had an epiphany about stores like this.
I realized that the shorthand for something being art was just to have a bird on it.
Here's how that theory translated to the show Portlandia.
What a sad little tote bag. I know, I'll put a bird on it. Did you see this bag before? I didn't. Now there's a bird. It's flying. It's free.
Back in the real Portland, we put Carrie's theory to the test.
If I sat here and talked about every single bird item, we would be here for an hour or two, so I'm just going to breeze through.
At Tender Loving Empire, Andrew Sloan's business card says Minister of Creative Content.
Here's two brass birds kissing in front of a cloud on a necklace. Here we have a tie with, looks like a sparrow chasing a worm. Little owl here, here's a rooster, here's two little lovebirds together there.
Can I just mention that the 10 things with birds on them that you've just named are in a 1 square foot radius? We have not moved.
We haven't actually taken one step to our right or left. Mm-hmm. Could you help but notice the wings spanning from the center of that mythological cat?
Even cats have to be birds in Portland in order to get any respect.
Everything I've seen about Portlandia is going to squash Portland. Like, you watch that show and you're just like, no, yes, but no.
I feel the same way, but I feel like that's what it's like to live here a little bit. There's part of you that's cringing, but at the same time, you wouldn't live anywhere else.
The first episode of Portlandia airs tonight on IFC. Ari Shapiro, NPR News.
We've got clips from Portlandia on the blog Monkey See at our website, npr.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News, produced by Nicole Beemster-Bohr, Kara Tallow, and Tracy Wall. Our senior producers include Tom Bullock, Cindy Carpian, Barry Gordimer, and Jim Wildman.
Our executive producer is Madalika Sicca. The executive director of news programming is Ellen McDonald. Morning Edition's theme music was written by B.J. Lederman and arranged by Jim Pugh. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Million viewers went there last night, and Robert, we're going to go there too.
That's right, because we are the program that considers all things.
That's right.
Including American Idol. The show's season premiere was on last night without cranky Simon Cowell or spacey Paula Abdul.
So we have enlisted our own cranky panel of pop culture mavens.
Linda Holmes, the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See.
Andrew Wallenstein, senior editor of the website Paid Content.
Jasmine Garst, host of Alt Latino on NPR Music.
Their mission, to see if this new American Idol is a hit or a miss.
Watching the beginning of the 10th season of American Idol, it is the 10th season, it seemed a little bit like a sick kid's birthday party. You got plenty of clowns and it's still sort of depressing. The big news is supposed to be they added Steven Tyler and Jennifer Lopez. Steven Tyler obviously is from Aerosmith. Jennifer Lopez is a singer and she's an actress, but she's mostly just shiny and famous. Neither one of them, I don't think, turned out to have a particularly sharp tongue like Simon Cowell did. He left at the end of last season. But Steven Tyler is definitely bizarre enough to be good to watch on TV. But he had a few problems, including the fact that he cannot seem to figure out what is and is not appropriate to say about the skirt that's being worn by a 16-year-old.
Just the right amount showing. That's nice.
That is just really gross, is what that is.
But you know what? I'm glad you're bringing up Victoria, because she was one of several instances on the show that proved to me just how badly the show is now missing Simon. She, and there was another contestant too, Ashley Sullivan, they just had no business being pushed through to Hollywood.
Give me that thing called love.
Now, if Simon was there, this girl would not have made it through. And neither would have Victoria Huggins. When you don't have the dark overlord that is Simon, you lack spine at the judging table.
It's a yes for me.
It's not just about having someone who's going to rip these people to shreds. It's about maintaining a sense of standards. And I just didn't feel that.
Well, you know, if we're going to talk about standards, it's just really hard for me to say which of all the auditions I like best. Because at some point, I found myself wondering, you know, if voices that I love, like Bjork or PJ Harvey or Billie Holiday had auditioned for this show, would they have passed?
No.
Probably not.
No.
If I have to make a pick, as a former waitress, I'd pick the singing waitress, Devin Rush.
Mama may have, and Papa may have, but God bless the child, it's got his own.
In a sea of overly made-up contestants, she was just like a hard-working girl with very little makeup, jeans, a t-shirt, and sneakers, who was just feeling the music, and she really won my heart.
So if we had to look over the whole show and say, yes or no, you're going to Hollywood, what would you say? Jasmine, what would you say?
I just can't, no.
How about you, Andrew?
I'm going to side with Jasmine. The curiosity factor brought me in. I wanted to see how J-Lo and Tyler would do. I've seen enough.
Yeah, I'd have to go along with that, too, and say no. So that's three no's, which means new American Idol, dog, you are not going to Hollywood.
That's our panel of pop culture fans.
Linda Holmes, the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See.
Andrew Wallenstein, senior editor of the website Paid Content.
Jasmine Garst, host of Alt Latino on NPR Music.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.